summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. So goes Summertime, the classic song of plenty amid poverty in George Gershwin's folk opera Porgy and Bess. On the other hand, we have fast food fish fries.
It's time to indulge in Red Lobster's big seafood festival. Succulent rock lobster tail and king crab with decadent jumbo shrimp scampi.
Plenty more fish where that one came from, your friend consoles you when yours takes the bait but keeps his freedom. Enough for platters full of fish and chips, live lobster tanks, and all-you-can-eat shrimp buffets.
The bigger the seafood, the bigger the celebration. So come in and feast before it's over. Only at Red Lobster.
Before it's over? Of course, they mean before their special offer expires. But a new study of global fish stocks indicates a much broader and more ominous trend. At current rates of consumption and depletion, fisheries worldwide may collapse altogether in just 40 years, falling victim to pollution, over-harvesting, habitat destruction, global warming, and other largely humanly induced changes. If we don't act decisively and soon, there will be little or no seafood on our plates by 2048.
The real key here, I think, with fishing is if you want to protect fish stocks, you just need to kill less fish.
Today on A World of Possibilities, Fished Out, draining the seas of their bounty. Hard as it is to imagine, we may be on the verge of exhausting the oceans of the seafood that's a culinary delight and a rich source of protein to some of us and a survival ration to many of the world's poorest people. Cod and Atlantic salmon, the signature fish of New England, the once vast salmon stocks of the Pacific Northwest, swordfish in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere. One after another of the great fisheries has been closed and species declared endangered.
The loss of species erodes the very ability of the system to self-repair and to recover on its own.
Fortunately, some marine biologists, policymakers, and most of all fishermen themselves hear the warning bells and are working hard to turn these trends around.
It's a challenge that we're going to prove this report wrong.
You can, in fact, have your cake and eat it too, or have your fish and eat them too.
My name is Mark Sommer. Join us as we explore the most effective options to save our seafood and the seas themselves in the process. Welcome to A World of Possibilities. We're standing on a fishing pier on the sparkling, rock-studded coast of Northern California. From here, you can look westward at a limitless horizon that doesn't reach landfall for 8,000 miles. Given the scale of the world's oceans, nearly all of us have long assumed that they'd supply an endless bounty of wild food for the harvesting. After all, the oceans are the very definition of vastness, and they're teeming with fish. Well, they are indeed vast, but full of fish? Less so all the time. A comprehensive international survey published in the fall of 2006 in the peer-reviewed journal Science predicts that if current trends hold, seafood could largely disappear from our plates as soon as 2048. In a moment, we'll hear from the study's lead researcher. But first, let's hear from someone who's actually baiting the hooks. Pietro Paravano, president of the Institute for Fisheries Resources, is himself a commercial fisherman who drops his lines in waters off the Northern California coast in search of salmon, crab, and rockfish. He's alarmed by the dire predictions of the study, but says it's not too late to turn things around. Pietro Paravano joins us from the studios of public radio station KQED in San Francisco. Sustainable farming has become a buzzword in food circles and agricultural circles, and sustainable fishing has evidently also entered into the vocabulary. What does that mean in practical terms?
The ability to bring us into the future, not only as fishermen, but also bring the fish into the future so that way the consumers will have, you know, some fresh fish to eat. I think that's the direction that we have to go.
Let's, for a moment, go right down to the sea.
Okay.
Take us out there.
I would love to.
Take us out there.
I would love to, because it's pretty lonely at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So if I can share this, it would be great. First of all, I say that fishing is the very last thing that one gets to do. One has to have a boat that runs well. You know, you have to maintain the boat, so you have to be mechanically inclined. You have to know your fishing grounds, where the salmon are going to be. You have to have the right equipment. You have to know how to tie your knots properly. So you got to have all these things in place by the time you even leave the dock in the morning. You have to get enough fuel. You have to get enough ice. So that way it keeps your catch nice and cold. So you get up in the morning, and first of all, you listen to the weather, make sure that weather is going to be okay. And usually in the summertime, you know, the weather patterns are a lot more comfortable. So you venture on out and you start monitoring different indicators. One indicator is the temperature of the water. The salmon require 52 to 56 degree temperature waters. Then you look for the color of the water. And it's something that we call dirty water. And the dirty water indicates that this water is full of plankton that salmon love to eat. So you look for that as opposed to a bright green and bluish types of water. Other indicators are bird life. If the birds are feeding in an area, you know, that means that there's feed in there. Whales are another indicator that there's a feed to support the whales. So salmon and whales they swim together. And then you kind of put these things together, and all of a sudden, you know, you put your hooks in, and we're allowed to have only 6 lines. So you put 3 on the port side and 3 on the starboard side. And in order to take our lines down to the various depths, we have these lead weights from 30 to 40 to 60 pounds. And we use girdies, which are hydraulic spools that will let the stainless steel wire go out. And then attach the stainless steel wire, every 3 fathoms, we have a stop where we put our leader. And the leader is all monofilament. And behind the monofilament, you put your bait or your lures or your plugs. And they all have to be barbless hooks. Then after we bring the fish on board, we clean it and we put it in a seawater bath. So that way the salt from the seawater will displace any blood that's in the veins. And then within 20, 30 minutes, we put it in this ice slush, which is made of ice, which we got at the docks before we left, and seawater. So the temperature of that slush is pretty doggone cold. And we keep the salmon in there until we unload the boat.
Is your relationship to salmon as a salmon fisherman a little bit like the Native American to the buffalo in the old days? It's your touchstone for what fishing is really about?
You know, Mark, that's a very good question. And it is for me, because that was the very first fish that I ever caught in the ocean. But I'm very connected to salmon. I feel, you know, not only was salmon was the first fish that I ever caught in the ocean, when I first did it commercially, I remember drinking blood from that first salmon.
Wow.
And that was my connection with that salmon.
Do you have confidence that we can actually turn this around so that the salmon can run freely again and we can live well with them on into the future?
You know, Mark, I don't think I would continue my work in advocating sustainability and the professionalism of my fellow fishermen in this country unless I had a belief that something can be done. And, you know, when this report came out with the collapse of fisheries by 2048, at first I thought, geez, you know, the fishermen can't take another hit. But once you read the report and you start understanding what the report meant, is that this is a challenge, that we're going to be able to prove this report wrong, that by 2048, we are going to be having fish. You know, that this is a challenge for us as fishermen to say, we're not going away. But we need a lot more help. We need the data. We need the help of government. And then I think we can really start repairing a lot of this habitat that has been destroyed by development, by pollution. You know, you get away from the emotional aspects of it and say, oh my God, you know, there's going to be no more fishermen around, there'll be no more coastal communities around. But instead, it's a challenge that we're going to prove this report wrong.
Pietro Parabano. The report he hopes to prove wrong is based on the work of an international team of marine biologists led by Dr. Boris Voren, a professor of marine conservation biology at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He thinks that Pietro and others can do a lot to reverse the alarming trends he sees, and says a collapse of the world's fisheries can be avoided if we begin acting soon to put a stop to ocean pollution, overfishing, and the capture of unwanted fish in nets, and if steps are taken to protect ocean habitats, reduce the impacts of climate change, and to control toxins that are dumped into ocean waters. Dr. Voim joins us now from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Halifax. I was really struck when I read in the New York Times of a study in which you were the lead researcher on the prospective global collapse of fish species by 2048. What was the basis of this startling finding?
Well, this was the headline. Our report was actually about a broader phenomenon, which is the depletion of ocean species, period. So not just fish, but all the ocean species that are making up ocean ecosystem. And we documented that we have been losing species from ecosystems for a long time, actually for hundreds of years. But this trend has accelerated recently. And what we've also shown is that as we're losing species, that directly threatens human well-being by undermining the ocean's ability to provide food, seafood mostly, maintain water quality, and to recover from perturbations such as overfishing and climate change. The 2048 figure has been controversial because we base it on catch records. So this is the total catch of seafood species we're getting from the oceans, including all species from clams and mussels all the way up to tuna and cod and swordfish and so on. And we're looking at the trend of catches in these species. And what we see is that more and more of these species are in the collapse categories, which means that the catch has declined by 90% or more, meaning we're not able to get out of those species what we used to be able to get out of them. And every year it's more of them. So 1980, for example, was 13%, and now we're at 29% or so, and it's accelerating, and it's going in the wrong direction.
Who participated in this study, over how long a period of time, and what were the indices that you were looking at?
Yeah, so it's actually an interesting story how this came about. This study was initiated by a comment from a journalist at an international conference 4 years ago, where she said she didn't understand what the evidence was that ocean species were important for humans, because most of us never see them, they're veiled by the water, we don't understand what's changing, and we certainly don't understand how it's impacting our personal lives. So we set out with 14 individuals, marine biologists and economists, to study how changes in the ocean species portfolio were impacting our economy and our well-being. So we were meeting for over a period of 3 years, bringing together vast amounts of data from four different fields. The first was experiments that people have been doing, where they, in a controlled environment, manipulated the number of species and saw how the ecosystem changed. The second was a 1,000-year historical study of historical changes in 12 different ecosystems, coastally, worldwide. The third one was a global compilation of catch data that I've just previously mentioned from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization database. And the last one was a study of recovery, how biodiversity, the number of species in an ecosystem, recovers once they are protected in the marine ecosystem, and what the consequences of that recovery would be.
As I understand it, you were monitoring a room full of students taking an exam that I assume you were administering when you were working on your laptop on various figures and suddenly realized the trend lines. And now I realize what the professors up at the front of the class were actually doing when we were struggling over our exams. You were making grand discoveries on our time.
Well, we're supposed to, aren't we? that's part of the job description. I have to tell you, the supervising exams is about the most boring thing you can do. And it's also aggravating because people are beavering away, they're sweating, they're anxious, you know. So you try to do something more productive with your time, and that's what I did.
Tell us what happened exactly. You were sitting with the laptop.
Yeah. Well, it was a huge exam. It was not just my class, but a number of other classes writing their exams in a large hockey rink arena. This is how we do things in Canada. And this is hundreds and hundreds of students kind of on these small desks working away on their exam. And I sat there with a number of other profs overseeing the whole thing. And I was working on my laptop because, as I said, just to do something productive. And I was looking at the trend line and these data. And I asked myself, you know, where will we be in 50 years if this trend continues? Where will we be in 20 years? Where will we be in 70 years? This is a question I think that everybody would ask who sees a negative trend. Where does it lead us? And the answer was, if this would continue as it did for the last 50 years, we would be in big trouble very soon. So it's really important that we turn this trend line around. And the precise timing of collapse, I think, is less important than this trend, which is leading in the wrong direction.
When you saw this, did you get a sudden sense of a sort of visceral fear or dread at what was happening?
I tell you, in my profession, you get a lot of sense of dread. It was there too. Yeah. I mean, it's this sinking feeling that I often get when I look at large data sets because it's just so big. And it's, I understand how hard it is to turn it around. And yeah, it gives you certainly a feeling of a big, big challenge.
One of the findings, it seems, in your study is that you need to maintain the whole ecosystem, and that any time you pull species out of it, you're weakening its ability to withstand various kinds of other stresses.
That's correct. That's actually the main message of our paper, that the loss of species on the ocean does two things. First, the obvious, it erodes our portfolio of species that we can use for our benefit. If something's not there anymore, you can't fish it anymore. But second, and maybe more importantly, the loss of species erodes the very ability of the system to self-repair and to recover on its own. And I think ultimately that's more important, because if we're not even able to get it back anymore by protecting it, we're really in trouble. If you think about a fish like salmon or cod, you want to think about the whole structure of species, the supply chains, so to speak, that brought that fish to life and to maturity and finally on your plate. And so there would be a host of different food species that feed larvae, that feed juvenile fish, and that finally feed the adult fish. There would be habitat species such as seagrass or sponge reefs or other habitats that are important for juveniles to hide in and to grow up in. So there's a whole food chain and important habitats that are all made up of live species that the salmon or the cod needs in order to grow up. So we're really trying to get a sense of how all these species are interlinked in a very deep way.
When I go into just the local market, I'm seeing prawns from Thailand and fish farmed in Canada or Alaska, and quite a wide range. The local fish, less and less. We live on the north coast of California, where salmon has been the totem species forever. And by and large, the commercial fishing of salmon is almost completely gone from here.
Yeah. So it is in the Atlantic. Yeah, it's the last big wild fisheries for salmon is in Alaska, and it's not a coincidence. It's there because it has, from the early days, been relatively well managed. People not just concentrated on one or two stocks that tended to be productive, but they kept the whole portfolio of species and subspecies alive, and it's very, very tightly controlled, and people have a self-interest in keeping those fisheries going, not depleting them any more than they can sustain. And it's been a success story overall. So my point here is that the human need and the needs of the ecosystem really go hand in hand. You can't divorce one from the other. We need healthy ecosystems to sustain our economy and our livelihoods. And we get those services for free, but only if we treat the ecosystem in a way that maintains all its important parts, all the species that make it work.
Final thoughts about where we stand and how we could turn this around in time, that we could end up having actually a thriving seafood industry and a thriving sea again.
Yeah, I think that vision needs to be promoted much more. We need to envision how would it be if we had vibrant fishing communities again, if there were no concerns about swimming in the ocean due to pollution, if we would not find any plastic debris anymore that spoils beaches and underwater habitats. That vision, I think, is so positive and productive. And I found out through this research and through the media coverage, and the letters and emails and phone calls I got from everyday people, that people are really, really concerned about this. They really care about the ocean, and they really would like an ocean environment that's healthy and supporting, rather than an ocean environment that becomes a liability because of toxic algae blooms and oxygen depletion zones and starved fisheries and so on. So I think there's a lot of positive momentum right now. people who are concerned and who want to make a difference. And it's not a miracle. We know how to do this. We just need to take more aggressive, more decisive steps nationally and internationally to restore the oceans to their former splendor and beauty.
Boris Vorm. In a moment, a lesson for landlubbers about the relationship between the ocean, adjacent landscapes, and their rivers.
There's an interdependency between the land and the ocean that one can grasp by looking at the cycle of the salmon. Salmon are the one endangered species that we eat.
We'll meet author and documentary filmmaker Stephen Most after this short break.
Fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting round in no more. Well, fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting no more. They're taking up the catfish and grinding up the bone. Well, I was down East Texas, Jefferson Town. I had no catfish, had to turn around. Well, fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting no more.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
Out in the Pacific Northwest, in a rugged region spanning the California-Oregon line, is an untrammeled landscape of coastal headlands, inland alpine peaks, and wild rivers. It's the wilderness of Western myth, and it's long been at the heart of disputes involving water allocation and resource stewardship. Central among them is the overuse of the Klamath River, whose salmon-spawning waters provide a livelihood for farmers, ranchers, and the fishermen and Native American tribes who depend for their food and finances on a healthy population of wild salmon. 100 years ago, natives found salmon so plentiful one could virtually scamper across the Klamath's wide reach on the backs of migrating salmon. But today, the totem species of the Pacific Northwest is rapidly disappearing from the river, a victim of overfishing, warming waters, dams, upstream logging, and other disruptive activities. To hear more, we're joined now by documentary filmmaker Stephen Most, author of the recently published book, River of Renewal, Myth and History in the Klamath Basin. He joins us by phone from Berkeley, California.
There were tremendous numbers of salmon. In fact, there were several runs of salmon, so that at different times of year, there were sources of fish, and not only salmon, but sturgeon and lamprey eel and many other fish within the river system. So it was incredibly productive and a wonderful place for human beings to live because your food came to you.
That started to decline in noticeable ways at what point?
The decline of salmon in the Klamath Basin has occurred over a number of stages. The first major impact was the gold rush. The rivers were actually re-engineered in order to yield gold so that the river flowed dark, it was murky, it was not a good habitat. But by the late 19th century, there was a thriving cannery industry. And I should say that the prize fish of the Klamath, as of the Columbia River, was the spring Chinook. Well, when the dams came into the Klamath, that cut off hundreds of miles of habitat for the spring Chinook. Similarly, on the Columbia River, when the Grand Coulee Dam went in, it made the royal Chinook species extinct. They used to spawn up into Canada. Just a few years after the dams came in on the Klamath, one could see the impact on the cannery industry because the fish that normally would have been born in the upper reaches of the Klamath Basin were not able to reach the ocean and fatten and come back to the river. Now, later in the 20th century, there was an impact from forestry. When forestry became mechanized, when there were power saws and trucks and roads and so on, that had a tremendous impact on the habitat below the dams, and there was a decline in the salmon populations accordingly. Similarly, fishing has contributed to the decline in salmon populations. So there have been many different impacts on the Klamath River and on the salmon.
It is interesting, this whole relationship between the sea, the rivers, the land. The degradation of watersheds has a very direct relationship and impact on sea life. It seems like the Klamath really symbolizes that relationship and epitomizes it.
That's right. There's an interdependency between the land and the ocean that one can grasp by looking at the cycle of the salmon as an example. There aren't a lot of nutrients in the Klamath River system, but salmon, who spawn there and then go out into the ocean on their cycle of 3 or 4 years, bring nutrients back into the river system. And similarly, by providing habitat where salmon spawn and where they live the early part of their lives, the land is bringing salmon into the ocean ecosystem. So all of these are interconnected in ways that are not readily available for we human beings.
I must say that when I eat salmon, I've begun to feel that I need to develop a different relationship with salmon, more as a sacred species. And it somehow commands an extra level of respect.
Salmon are the one endangered species that we eat, that we have that intimate relationship with as consumers. But salmon, for those who live where salmon inhabit the rivers and spawn, is an inspiring creature. Salmon are spawning right now in the San Francisco Bay Area in Lagunitas Creek. And people have restored that creek so that coho salmon have access to it. And this is something that is inspiring. If you see salmon, if you see them leaping rapids, there's a kind of passion about them, a fervency to reach the goal of their origin, that inspires people. It makes people realize that with passion and commitment, we can do great things ourselves. We can do necessary things that are difficult.
I think of it, then the Klamath not only as a river of renewal, but a river of return, specifically because of the salmon cycle.
That's right. And unfortunately, in recent years, there have not been happy returns because the river has actually become toxic to fish. This is the main stem of the Klamath. And that's partly due to parasites that are there and to a toxic algae that collects in the reservoirs, which are like warm bathtubs. And so when when juveniles actually enter the main stem, they die. 80% were infested with one of these parasites. As a result of that, the entire commercial salmon fishery has been curtailed drastically. So the result of the toxic habitat in the Klamath River is calamitous for the fish, but also for those of us who love salmon and love to eat salmon.
Final question. It's around the renewal religion of the Klamath. Is there any effort on the part of people who still believe in this religion to bring it forth to a larger world as part of what we all need?
There has been a very serious effort at conflict resolution and consensus building among the communities of the Klamath Basin. And it's gone beyond that. The tribes have gone to Scotland. The dams used to be owned by Scottish Power, saying that what you do affects our lives in California. The effort at fixing the world, at bringing new communities into this renewal, this understanding of our responsibility for where we live, has been engaged in by the tribes within the Klamath Basin primarily. What they have done is acted as leaders among the other communities, among the farmers and the ranchers, in educating them about how their actions have an effect on the salmon and how they can change their ways of living and working so that there will be a habitat, a place where they can fish and enjoy nature for coming generations. And I hope that that will extend itself beyond the Klamath Basin, that people everywhere will be able to learn about the world renewal potential that we all have.
Stephen Most, author of River of Renewal. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.